Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we're going to be taking a deep dive into the Finsbury Growth and Income Investment Trust. We're going to be looking at their strategy, portfolio construction and some of the key themes that they're looking to capitalise on out there in markets at this point in time. And to do that, we're very kindly joined today by Nick Train, who is the fund manager of the Finsbury Growth and Income Investment Trust. Nick, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
I'm grateful for the invitation to discuss the strategy. I think there is a lot to say about both the strategy and, to an extent, the UK stock market. And I'm keen to field any questions you might have.
Indeed, and it's a very nice introduction there, Nick. Thank you, because this podcast is going to be breaking up into really two sections. We're going to be looking at the investment trust, and we're also going to be looking at the market the investment trust is operating, and of course that is the UK equity market. But before we get into it, Nick, could you give us an introduction, first of all, to yourself, as well as the Finsbury Growth and Income Investment Trust, for those that may not be aware?
Sure. Maybe the proudest achievement, maybe it is an achievement of my career, is that I have been the named manager for Finsbury Growth and Income Trust for very nearly a quarter of a century. I think it was December. This coming December will mark a quarter of a century responsibility for Finsbury. And that's kind of been I'd regard it as a crowning pinnacle of my entire career. I've been involved with markets since the early 1980s. I've been following the UK stock market pretty much since the early 1980s. I sometimes think, well, if only I hadn't spent so much time on the UK, maybe I could have had a career. But no, the UK stock market actually hasn't done so badly over time. I know it's been a bit disappointing over the last decade, but I think there are plenty of reasons not to be pessimistic about either the UK stock market or indeed the UK economy. Of course, those are two very different things, but I still am stimulated by the challenge. And, you know, a question you could ask me is, what is the objective of Finsbury Growth and Income Trust? And I suppose ostensibly, you know, what I'm measured against, what I'm asked to do, is to outperform the FT All Share Index over time. And absolutely, I think that is a valid measure of if we have any value to add. But I have to say, I'm also, as well as being the manager of Finsbury, if I may say so, I'm also a very significant personal shareholder in the trust. I'm, by some very considerable margin, the biggest chunk of my personal savings are invested in the shares of Finsbury. And yes, I think about beating the market, but the way I think about it really is that we own a number of investments in Finsbury, UK shares in UK companies, some of which we've held for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years in some cases. And a number of these companies, when you look back over time, have doubled, trebled, quadrupled. And I think there's every reason to believe that you can find opportunities like that in the UK stock market. And I'd love to believe that, I don't know, just to name two, for instance, two big holdings in Finsbury, RELX and Diageo, both of those, you know, they've done really well so far over the 21st century. And I think there's grounds to believe that they could do even better over the next 25 years.
That's a fantastic introduction. Thank you very much, Nick. And you've mentioned two portfolio holdings there, and we will get stuck into the portfolio in a little bit more detail a bit later on in the podcast. You touched on your objectives there, and of course, you know, that is to outperform the benchmark. Could we go a little bit deeper into the strategy and what you're doing from a very top level? We'll discuss it in more detail as the podcast progresses, but just to set the scene, you know, what is it that you feel sets Finsbury apart from other UK equity trusts out there?
I mean, I think the most succinct and I hope full of information response to that is to say that I and my business partner, Michael Linsall, we got exposed to Berkshire Hathaway and Warren Buffett at an impressionable stage of our careers and life journeys, if you know what I mean. And reading about and coming to understand the discipline and the drivers behind Berkshire Hathaway's, Warren Buffett's success, it had a huge influence on me. And sometime in the late 1980s, early 1990s, I decided I was going to adopt as many of those principles as I understood and felt comfortable with into the way that I approached the challenge of trying to make money for people out of the UK stock market. And I suppose the two interrelated core ideas here are embracing portfolio concentration. You know, that was a big, big lesson from Berkshire Hathaway, that running a concentrated portfolio increases your chances of delivering different performance. Now, of course, it can be different and bad, which isn't the objective. But in order to survive and prosper in this industry, you've got to take some sort of risk and do something different. And Buffett's example of running a highly concentrated portfolio, that was the key insight for me. Now, there's a related and really, really important caveat or supplementary comment on top of portfolio concentration. And that is, do your utmost to ensure that what you're concentrated on, what you've concentrated the portfolio on, are exceptional, substantive, durable businesses. Many, many companies turn out to be ephemeral, short-lived, or just plain average, and they become dead weight in your portfolio. But if you can focus your attention on a limited number of exceptional businesses, then listen, everybody in my industry overpromises, and I mustn't do that, and I'm not in a position really to do it today. But if you run a concentrated portfolio of fine companies, then you increase the chance of good things happening over time. That's what I would say.
Just one question on that approach. You've taken the decision to be highly concentrated. Do you ever look at the wider market and think, actually, maybe this is a time to be a little bit broader in approach? And, you know, do you have periods where you're a little bit more concentrated and other times that you're broader? Or is it a real concentration all the way through the ups and downs of the market cycles?
I think that there's an intellectual and to some extent an emotional commitment to running a concentrated portfolio. I just fundamentally think that gives me and my colleagues the best chance, sadly never the certainty, but it gives us the best chance of delivering the exceptional returns that we aspire to. I think I'd acknowledge that the way I've worked, I've tended to work with what I've regarded as multi-year, sometimes even multi-decade thematic ideas, and built portfolios around those long-term high conviction ideas. When a new idea emerges, it may be that we can find more new ideas to participate in that new thematic idea. And it's possible that over that period, there might be a few more holdings in the portfolio than in the prior period, if that makes sense. I mean, we've bought 4 new holdings in the last, let's say, 15 months or something. By my standards, that's hyperactive, actually, and it has at the margin increased the number of holdings. At the heart of this, the fundamental idea is the concentration.
Of course, we're going to be talking about the UK in some detail. We're going to be talking about companies that are listed here, but maybe not necessarily operating here in the UK economy. So I think we should discuss something that you highlighted at the beginning, which was that the UK's valuation, and it has indeed been undervalued for some time. To maybe look at some context for the rest of the conversation and the portfolio holdings that we're going to get stuck into, what do you see as a UK manager as potential catalysts that could really spark a re-rating in the UK as a whole?
I mean, it's interesting that you say that the market is undervalued. And, obviously it has had a bit of a bounce this year. I think it's true to say still that the short to medium term prospects for earnings growth for the UK stock market is around mid-single digits. I don't know, 4 or 5% earnings growth, which, isn't very exciting. And, that looking back, that relatively dull index underlying growth of the businesses, it certainly seems to me to go a considerable way to explain why the UK has been a disappointing market for some time. And I have to say, I don't see what makes earnings growth for the UK stock market in its entirety double from 5 to 10% in short order, just to be clear. But maybe can I kind of tell an anecdote that I hope helps explain how I think about it? Now, I must be absolutely clear here. We do not own Rolls-Royce. And that's probably my bad, because it's done very, very well over the last few years, as I'm sure your listeners know. And we'll carry on thinking about Rolls-Royce. But one thing I really liked about Rolls-Royce was, I think it was 2 or 3 months ago, the chief executive of Rolls-Royce kind of gave a public challenge to the company to become the number one biggest listed company on the UK stock market. What is it, about 6th or 7th now in terms of size? And, that's a sporting challenge to put to the company. And maybe Rolls-Royce can do it. Who knows? Maybe it can do it. But my perspective on that is what it made me think about is, and I've already mentioned this company once, we have a big holding in RELX. It's a data business, basically. And think about RELX like this. Back in 2000, RELX was, I think, the 68th biggest company in the FTSE 100. Now, today, actually, I haven't looked at this for a month, but bear with me. Last time I looked, about a month ago, RELX was the 9th biggest company in the FTSE 100. In other words, since 2000, and I mentioned it, the shares have done well, really well over that period. And that's moved RELX from well into the bottom half of the FTSE 100 to being a top 10 company. And the last time I saw the chief executive of RELX, I said to him at the end of the meeting, and, slightly tongue in cheek, I said, well, listen, Eric, his name is Eric Engstrom, he's done a fantastic job at RELX. I said, Eric, well, if Rolls-Royce can say they've got a chance of becoming the biggest company in the UK, I'm going to lay down a challenge to you. I want RELX to give Rolls-Royce a run for its money. And let's see whether RELX can go from the 68th biggest company to the 9th biggest company. Maybe in another 5 years' time, RELX could be the biggest company in the UK stock market. And it's not such a far-fetched proposition. Engstrom said to me, he brushed it off, but he stopped and he thought for a moment and he said, okay, Nick, he said, I suppose 20 years ago, he said, our biggest division today, 20 years ago, that only represented about 2% of the value of RELX back in 2004. Today, the biggest division, which is their risk division, which is in fraud and insurance industry data, is worth over half the value of the company. And as he said, our risk division is growing more quickly than ever before today, and its market opportunities are better than ever before today. So maybe, if that risk division carries on growing at that rate, maybe RELX could become the biggest company in the UK stock market. Now, that is a long and rambling anecdote. I think what I'm saying is that to us, there are a number of substantive, big UK companies that are both world-class and have world-class growth opportunities as well. And if those companies can capitalize on those growth opportunities and their share prices go up and their market capitalizations expand, that has the potential over time sort of healing the UK stock market and getting better returns from the index as a whole. But it's going to come, not in my view, not from a market-wide re-rating, but it will come from good companies getting bigger and getting more profitable.
That was great. And it actually takes me very nicely on to my next point here, Nick, which is how the portfolio has evolved over time and how you have increased your weighting into those companies that you see pushing the UK market forward as a whole. So I understand that there's been some quite interesting changes from around 2019 to where we are now. And that is predominantly been an increase in exposure to digital companies. So could you just talk us through that, please, if you may, Nick? And, you know, when you're looking at these companies, of course, you've mentioned RELX there, and we'll discuss some of the other portfolio holdings in more detail later on in the podcast. But when you're actually looking at these companies that you feel have the power to become bigger companies and really push the UK forward, what do you have in place? What screeners do you have in place? What frameworks do you have in place? And I think this is probably a point now that we're going to start to bring in AI, which is going to be a dominant theme for the rest of the conversation.
I hope this isn't boring, and let me try and be as succinct as possible. So, as I said, nearly a quarter of a century of running this strategy. I'd say that for the first nearly two decades, through to 2019, 2020, maybe 2021, the dominant theme within Finsbury's portfolio was an exposure to companies that own global consumer brands. And actually, for the first couple of decades of the 21st century, they worked really well. We made a lot of capital gains for our investors having a big exposure to those consumer-type stocks. However, from around 2019, for a variety of reasons, some of them I suspect permanent, those consumer companies began to suffer from both more difficult trading conditions, but also their share prices began to underperform, maybe because of the valuations that they'd achieved, but also because there were other industries, companies emerging that seemed to offer better growth prospects, but with the same sort of cash generation and consistency that the best of the consumer staples historically offered. And I don't know, for me, there was a time in the, 2021, 2022, as I was looking at an important part of my portfolio, the staple stocks underperforming, but I was also looking at, and as I've said, we already owned RELX. We already owned, I haven't mentioned this company yet, we already owned London Stock Exchange Group, which is another data-type company similar to RELX in some regards. I could see that the shares of those data businesses were performing extremely well. And it led me to the conclusion that we needed to reduce the exposure to consumer staples. We still own some. Maybe there's time to talk about one or two later. I don't know. Reduce the exposure there and to take advantage of what it turns out to be a number of London-listed companies that have world-class data analytics, platform-type characteristics that are available for us to invest in the UK. And the portfolio has pivoted to a material extent. I mean, let me just put a number on this. Today, that set of data businesses, let's just call them broadly data stroke digital businesses, they now amount to just under 60% of the portfolio. So they've become a really dominant theme. Let's hope we're right, because we need those ideas to work to generate the returns that we aspire to. So what are we looking for? I mean, I guess simply stated, we're looking for businesses that offer insights and or other services that their customers can't do without. And I think people readily understand that a software service or access to a set of data insights that can only be provided by one company because the data is proprietary to that company, or a company with a platform, let's say Rightmove, for instance, which is an important holding for us, a platform where there are such strong network effects where if consumers visit that site, then agents have to list inventory on that site. Those are the sort of reliably predictable, cash generative type assets that we've always liked. The consumer staples had those characteristics. Maybe they're losing them to a degree, but these companies have those characteristics. But, and maybe we do talk about AI, I don't know, but maybe the advent of artificial intelligence makes these data owners growth opportunity even more, an even bigger growth opportunity.
Some notes there. So, of course, you like data companies, but it's interesting there that you mentioned that it's data that people can't do without. But there's lots of different things that people can't do without. You know, if you look at Tesco, people can't do without food, for example. But what is it about data for you that really creates value? And you did touch on it in your previous points, but I really want to go back to the fundamentals of data as a business, and a business that is heavily involved in data. What are the key attributes that set those types of businesses apart from other businesses out there that are available within your universe? And how important is it? And again, you know, the answer to this may be obvious, but I'd like to get your perspective of how important is it to be involved in companies that are data heavy in the age of AI?
Just talking about an individual company, let me just say a little bit more about RELX. Let's try and pick another company as well. So RELX, up until 2020, RELX's business, its revenues had been growing steadily at around 4 to 5% per annum for the previous decade. Since 2020, basically, RELX's growth rate has doubled. It's now growing its group revenues more like 8-9%. And what's changed is that over the last 5 years, RELX has been able to deploy new large language model tools to its proprietary data that lawyers, members of the insurance industry, or scientific researchers simply can't do their jobs without access to that data. They've been able to overlay new tools on top of that data to provide new insights and to provide efficiencies to those professionals' work lives. And that makes RELX's services even more valuable and even more sticky, and has helped, as I say, effectively double the company's growth rate. RELX's legal division, LexisNexis, has just reported revenue growth of 9%. That is nearly treble the growth rate prior to 2020. And it's exactly because RELX has been able to offer particularly US legal practices with new tools and services that save minutes or hours of partners' billing time. So a company I haven't mentioned yet that's a big holding and actually a more recent holding in Finsbury is Experian, which your listeners may know, I'm sure you know, Jonathan, is the largest credit bureau in the world and the largest credit bureau in the world's largest economy, which is the United States. Experian has data on, I think the company says, 1.4 billion individuals around the world and 150 million companies around the world. Now, that data is not in the public domain. That data is not available to, in some cases, any other credit bureau, let alone any other, well, let's put it this way, let alone a random AI agent. So only Experian can derive information from that data, and the value that it derives from its data for its customers is of extraordinary value. 20 out of the top 25 financial institutions in the United States use Experian's Ascend tool or service, which allows financial institutions to make rewarding judgments about the creditworthiness of individuals. It's absolutely critical for the profitability and, you know, balance sheet integrity of the financial services industry that they access this data. And apart from Experian, there really aren't that many other places where they can get it. So I'd say that those are examples. I think what's so compelling, and, you know, this is a lesson that we've learned watching NASDAQ, is that these types of software platform data businesses, that they have, because of these new tools, they have truly a secular medium to long term growth opportunity. And yet their businesses are intrinsically capital light. And by that I mean that when they grow, they don't need to invest heavily in new plant and machinery. For much of the 20th century, growth was expensive because companies needed to buy more real estate or more machinery or dig more mines in order to deliver that growth. What's so compelling about the opportunity, it seems to us, about these data and platform type businesses is that although sure, they've got to keep investing in their software, they've got to keep investing in their technology, the businesses, it doesn't cost them much to grow. I was looking, we've got a holding in Sage. Sage reported its results last week. Earnings per share for the year were up 18%. That was good. We were pleased to see that. But what Sage was able to point out was that its return on capital, so its profits expressed as a proportion of its capital employed, this year, or last year, let's say, because this was the full year results, has risen from 26%, which was already a high return on capital, to 31% for the year that's just gone past. Sage grew its revenues at 9 to 10%, and yet its headcount was static for the year. So do you see that these businesses have the potential to grow as they deploy technology, but they can do so with improving returns to capital? That ought to be a very, very attractive combination.
I will note that one of the other businesses that you mentioned that you hold in your portfolio, something that I noticed for many years, Rightmove had the highest return on capital employed of the FTSE 350. So, of course, that seems like a metric that you're very much focused on there, and it does lend itself towards those data-heavy businesses. But I would like to discuss the other side of the portfolio now, Nick, because you mentioned at the beginning consumer companies, of course, as a percentage of the overall portfolio, it's a lot smaller than it once was. But there are still some holdings in there. Diageo is an interesting one.
Very interesting.
So if we could pay a bit of attention to those now.
Yeah, I'm going to remain an unapologetic advocate for the owner or for owning, let's call them semi-eternal consumer brands. Nothing is truly eternal. Nothing truly lasts forever. But if you can find consumer brands which you know that consumers aspire to purchase or to enjoy, and if you've got grounds for believing that consumer brand is going to remain relevant over a meaningful investment time period, then you own something that's both rare and theoretically very valuable indeed. I put it to, just to give an idea here about what one might be saying, I, I put it to an investor recently, think back to 2000. And in 2000, if someone had offered you the choice of investing, oh, let's be ridiculous, your entire net worth into either Nokia or, let's say, Guinness, what would you have chosen in 2000? Now, listen, the answer's obvious and you know, what befell Nokia is, you can't extrapolate from that. But I think, you know, turning it the other way, looking at the enduring power of Guinness as a brand, Guinness has continued to grow, Guinness is growing its volumes, Guinness continues to be able to price its product in line or ahead of inflation. That's an extraordinarily attractive asset to have as part of your portfolio. And so, you know, I look at the consumer brands that we still have exposure to in Finsbury. Listen, I know that Guinness, I think Guinness is about 15% of Diageo. So it's important. Obviously, it's not the whole of Diageo by any means. But when you look dispassionately at Diageo's other leading brands, it seems as likely as anything is likely in this world that Johnnie Walker, Tanqueray, those incredible single malt brands that Diageo owns, Don Julio, tequila, Hennessy cognac, though those will still be being consumed probably in greater volumes in 25 years' time than they are today. And that is the basis for, you know, both capital preservation and over time wealth creation. Even after this horrendous, and listen, I've worn all of this share price fall in Diageo. I feel humbled by it, frankly. But, you know, we did own this back in 2000 and it was trading at £5 a share. You know, it's £17.50 now. You know, it's not done so badly. The recent setback has been horrid, but there we are. We own, you know, we own Burberry. I think that is a unique brand in the context of the UK stock market and a kind of a semi-eternal type brand. We own Fevertree. That is, you know, a unique global brand. There is no other global premium mixer brand in the world, and Fevertree is in the process of conquering the world. You know, maybe you regard this as ridiculous. I mean, we've got a, by our standards, a relatively modest holding, just around 1% in Manchester United. But again, that sort of totally unique franchise or brand, I still think, you know, you'll look up in 10 years' time and you'll say they've endured and they're worth a lot more today than they were 10 years ago.
Indeed. That's fascinating, Nick. One question that I do have that just sprung to mind. If you look over the last 5 or 6 years, of course, the portfolio has become more heavily weighted towards digital businesses, those involved in data. Do you see that as a trend that's set to continue? Do you see your weighting towards those types of company continuing to increase? Or are you at a stage now where you're fairly happy with the balance or maybe a little bit wary of going too heavily into that area?
Listen, I hope the exposure goes up a lot, but it goes up because the share prices do extremely well. You know, that would be the ambition. Let me answer the question, if I may, this way. We initiated in a new holding about 15 months ago, a relatively small company in the UK, a company called Clarkson, shipbroking business. Now, not many people, I don't think, would regard Clarkson as a, let's call it, a digital winner. But actually, what's fascinating about that company is that it does generate data on the industry which it dominates. And increasingly, it's using the data that it generates about the maritime fleet to create new products and services for its global customer base. And if we could find more ideas like that, so I'm not saying that we need to go and buy another Relex, I mean, partly because they don't exist. We don't necessarily need to go and buy another pure data business, but I'm very, very interested in finding other UK listed companies that have, where there's the potential for AI and similar tools to be a beneficiary for those companies' businesses. And I just say that that was kind of the lens through which we're looking at an array of opportunities in the UK stock market. Yes, it does sound as though we've got quite a concentration on those digital ideas, but actually when you consider the array of industries that the companies are separately giving exposure to, actually I think it's much more diverse than you might think.
That's a really interesting point, Nick. So I have another question here. You obviously have those two buckets as such. I don't know if you call them buckets, but that's maybe how we'll frame them for this question. Do you see an opportunity for companies to have a foot in each of those? You know, consumer companies that are investing heavily in AI and data, but their main business is indeed being a consumer brand, but they're actually utilizing the technology to then push that forward. Do you see that something, so those blurring of lines going forward?
It is a very interesting question. Andy Grove, the no longer with us, the great chief executive of Intel in its glory days, was quoted as saying, I don't know, back in 2000 or something, in the future, every company will be an internet company, which maybe is too extreme an observation, but I think we can see what he meant, that learning how to utilize digital technology is going to become a crucial skill set for any business. And I think, you know, that continues to be true. But I think I'd like to keep the distinction in my mind. And, you know, while I think that LSEG's tick data, LSEG is the biggest vendor of real life prices in the world. And that's an extraordinary, valuable, unique position that LSEG has. That's very valuable. But to my mind, the taste of Guinness or the flash of genuine Czech on a Burberry scarf, that's also very distinctive and isn't going to be disintermediated by tech. I think it's important the way we try and frame everything is this asset, whether it's a digital asset or a tangible asset, is this asset likely to remain relevant and aspired to by its consumers in decades to come? You never know for sure, but you do know when you look back through financial history that the vast majority of corporations, like Nokia, you know, don't endure necessarily for decades. So again, that's the framework that we're thinking with.
A couple of questions here to finish things off. The next one is somewhat philosophical, and it's going back to technology companies, UK technology companies. And I saw a very interesting slide in one of your recent presentations where you're comparing Sage trading, I think it was about 5 or 6 times sales, compared to some of its competitors that were US listed, trading at around 10 to 15 times the sales, although doing very similar things. Do we have a problem in the UK with valuing technology companies? And if so, what are we missing and how can that be fixed?
I think it's probably too philosophical and too deep for me, to be candid. But I think what I would observe is that in 2016, UK investors, in hindsight, made a terrible mistake, which was selling Arm to SoftBank. You know, that might have looked clever on a 2-year view, taking the premium that SoftBank offered. But on a 10-year view, it's been a disaster. Arm would be one of the biggest companies listed on the UK stock market if UK institutions had held on to it. And that's kind of the old UK, isn't it? That, you know, institutions would proverbially sell their grandmothers for a 30% premium. Nonetheless, I thought it was very interesting, and going back to a company we've already mentioned a couple of times, that it was last year, wasn't it, that there was a bid for Rightmove. The Australian company REA bid for Rightmove. And the bid never got off the ground. UK institutional shareholders, including us, weren't interested in selling Rightmove at anything like the price that REA could have afforded, because we've watched NASDAQ and understand that platform businesses like this, as long as they execute well, you know, they can just carry on doubling and doubling and doubling again. I sincerely hope that that's going to be the case for Rightmove. So I do wonder whether, you know, the lesson from NASDAQ has begun to sink in. I mean, Steve Hare, who's the chief executive of Sage, you know, I thought it was interesting. He said last week at the time of the results, he said, I don't complain about the rating that Sage is trading on currently. The thing is, in the United States, people will pay for the promise of possible future business growth. And he said, well, you know, maybe they deliver, maybe they don't. His view was, from Sage's current valuation, if they can deliver the growth that they aspire to, all shareholders are going to do very well. I mean, shareholders have done well in Sage under Steve Hare's stewardship. So I'm not necessarily forecasting a big re-rating, but what I am hopeful for is that these companies can continue to grow at double digits. And if they do, that should drive very satisfactory returns.
To finish off now, we always like to ask this question. As a UK-focused manager, what excites you the most about the year ahead?
I'm an optimist. I think we should be optimistic about our corporate sector. I tell you, the framing for me is the PwC report about likely GDP growth between now and 2030, driven by the application of AI processes across industries. And PwC are predicting much, much stronger and a much greater quantum of GDP for Asia, for the Americas, and for Northern Europe as a result of AI. And yeah, I mean, looking at the business performance of the companies that we've got that are successfully utilizing AI, I can believe it. And it makes me think structurally one should be optimistic. I think the other thing to say, I think it was Goldman Sachs recently noted that there's a coming glut of liquefied natural gas. And I think Goldman Sachs are forecasting that gas prices might halve over the next couple of years. Now, if that were to coincide, and I sincerely, genuinely mean this, with, let's hope, peace in Ukraine and, you know, an opening up of Russia's energy sources again, maybe we're looking at a period over the next few years where you get a combination of falling energy costs, growth driven by this new generation of technology, and interest rates peaking out and consumers feeling more comfortable. And I think, you know, you then have an environment where you could see strong earnings growth. Let's hope so.
Indeed. And two of those factors actually really play into each other there. I mean, one of the concerns about AI at the moment is, of course, how it's going to be powered and the cost of powering it. So if we do see that reduction in power costs through lower gas prices and fossil fuel prices, that will indeed help propel AI forward, which in turn will then help push the economy forward. So two really interesting points there, Nick. Thank you very much. Just as a note to listeners, do check out the notes to this podcast, because there'll be a link through to the Finsbury Growth and Income Investment Trust page. You'll be able to download the latest fact sheet and watch one of those videos that I've mentioned on a couple of occasions during this podcast. So Nick, thank you very much for being with us today.
Jonathan, thank you. And to anybody who's still listening, I hope it was interesting. Yeah, be optimistic.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much to everyone for listening.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice. And please remember, all investment involves risk.